Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
St. John Cassian begins his discussion of the capital vices with the following stated aims: that we may worthily investigate their natures, which are so intricate, so hidden, and so obscure, then, so that we may adequately lay bare their cause, and third, so that we may suitably propose cures and remedies for them. We made a start yesterday of exploring the intricacy, hiddenness, and obscurity of these vices. Hidden from view by dint of their irrationality and by demonic deceit, they are yet revealed in the incarnation of Christ, especially in his temptation and passion. The monastic tradition witnessed by Evagrius, John Cassian, and others continued this work of Christ in the desert. These monks too were led to the desert by the Spirit to be tempted, not for its own sake, but to enter a deeper communion with their Savior and to reveal the weaknesses of the principalities, authorities, and the cosmic powers of this present darkness. The purpose of my talk today is to look with you to this monastic tradition as a source of experiential knowledge of vice on the way out, as it were, to look to these figures as models for how we can humbly accept temptation as an invitation to virtue, holiness, salvation, and ultimately union with Christ. I'll do this by way of thinking through how the capital vices are ordered and disordered. And at the end, I'm going to especially focus on the vice of pride and propose that experience with temptations to these vices can bring us to our final end, to the humble worship and glorification of God. Yesterday, I said that there were eight capital vices. I also said that these eight could be come under the labels of demons, thoughts, passions, and vices. But they are, after all, the seven deadly sins. So we're going to have to figure out how we get to eight. And there are seven of everything. Seven dwarves in Snow White, seven sacraments, seven virtues between the cardinal and theological virtues, 7 days of the week, seven ranks of angels, and so on. I also have suggested that it is understandable that different people at different times, and even the same person in John Cassian, might have proposed different orderings of these vices. And as part of the fruit of our reflections, I think that if we look to the development of this canonical list of seven vices or seven sins, we can learn something true and important about vice and virtue, and something important about our path to salvation. So you have on your handout a chart of the different lists of the capital vices. And John Cassian and Evagrius' lists are almost identical, but then there's a dramatic shift in the list of St. Gregory the Great. And then I added the list that appears in the Catechism for good measure. I'm going to present first the logic of Cassian and Evagrius' near identical ordering, and then I'll speculate as to why Gregory so dramatically changed the list and what it means for our fallen condition and our return to glory. Cassian presents the eight vices as four sets of twins. The first twins are natural or bodily sins. So these are gluttony and lust. They are related to our sense appetites. Gluttony relates to the continued maintenance and life of a single human body, whereas lust pertains to the continued maintenance and life of the whole human species. Cashin then moves on to greed and anger, which he says commonly arise because of an external provocation. So they don't come, in this sense, from our embodied state in the same way. One, the first of these he calls unnatural, greed, by which he means that our body itself doesn't crave money. We don't sit down for lunch and have a burrito and say, I wish I had $40 to eat instead. The other is natural. So anger comes emerges because of an external provocation, but it is still an appetite that pertains to our bodily condition or our physical makeup. The next two, sadness and acedia, don't require external provocation at all, Cashin says. And we're able to know this because these especially affect solitaries in the desert who live without external provocation. Finally, there are the utterly distinct twins at the end, vainglory and pride. Vainglory and pride are distinct from all of the others in the sense that they are primarily mental and or intellectual vices. But we need to get to an even more important and more important difference between pride and vainglory and all of the rest. And to do that, I'm going to offer a very brief synthesis of what Evagrius and Cashin say about the movement from one vice to the next through this list. All of the vices from gluttony to acedia for John Cashin exist in a chain of failures. And he says that these vices bubble up. And so there's a sense in which when we're full of the vice of gluttony, we bubble over into the vice of sexual lust. Okay, and we're going to qualify that later. But the sense is that succumbing to an earlier vice in the list weakens the monk in the face of the next temptation. It begins with gluttony. Gluttony can come in several forms, but it means for Evagrius and John Cashin the separation of eating food, or taking drink, a separation from the basic maintenance of the body, which is necessary for life. This can mean eating too much. It can mean eating outside of appointed times, for the monk stealing a snack before the appointed time for the meal. It can mean demanding various relishes, or very specific dishes. I personally hate peanut butter, so I know it's shocking to some people, but if I were served peanut butter, I would do anything I could to avoid the meal, maybe even getting out of the room. Gluttony then was linked to lust. And this is in part because of physiological theories of ancient medicine, but I think more fundamentally, because the oversatisfaction, the unreasonable satisfaction of one sense appetite leads not just to more of the thing, although we can see that in cycles of addiction. The more you get, the more you need the next time. It also leads to a desire for more kinds of things. Okay, so this is a connection between gluttony and lust. Your soul has taken the form from gluttony of an unnatural desire, and then this spills over into another sphere. Gluttony and lust then lead naturally to greed, because money is convertible to these sensual pleasures. If the objects of the lust of the belly are not at hand, they can at least be purchased. And to be purchased, cash reserves are required. Greed for the monk could mean many things, but it at least meant compromising the life of poverty, a life where the monk is made able to be simple of heart without the distraction of accumulating, preserving, and increasing his wealth. Greed causes him to hide extra money that he has made on the side or on the sly. It causes him to fantasize about extra comforts, the money itself produces new desires. Then when calamity strikes, when his extra wealth that he's made on the sly is discovered and confiscated, he's led right into the sin of anger and wrath. And he feels the urge of vengeance welling up inside him. And then when he's unable to exact vengeance and satisfy his wrath in a way that he hoped would calm him, he falls into a depressed sadness. What existed in his imagination and in his longing is discovered to be his own fabrication and is unreal. The heart that reached out and stretched toward a false goal collapses under its own weight into a heap. Sadness is accompanied by irritability, and the monk suspects that everyone is talking about him and passing judgment on him. Cashin says that the monk in the thrall of this demon of sadness will refuse to apologize for his mistakes. And even when another monk should apologize to him, he responds by spinning up a conspiracy theory in his mind about this apology. He's surely only apologizing because he's trying to get one up on me. Sadness then leads naturally to acedia. And this is the most complex of all the vices. Evagrius calls the demon of acedia the most oppressive of the demons, since this demon afflicts not only one aspect or power, but the whole human person in his totality. This demon perverts feelings of anger, feelings of desire, and even the rational part, along with the imagination. And he attacks them all together, all at once. So at least the way Evagrius describes it is like this, that isolated by sadness, because he's so suspicious of his brothers, the monk begins a cycle of hatred and desire. First, he hates the place. Then he hates his work. And then he hates his brothers. And finally, he hates even the passage of time itself. He asks himself, why is everything so terrible? Then to soothe this hatred, he's tempted by the demon to enter in upon a series of alternative desires. And he dreams of a better place, a more profitable, maybe even more spiritual kind of work, better brothers who actually love each other, who aren't always offending and annoying him, and maybe even a better time than this time, lunchtime. That's in the past now, so I'll have to wait till tomorrow. These desires can even have a pious tone. At that other monastery, I'll have the support I need from more mature monks. I'll be ready and able to serve God as I'm capable of serving him. Maybe I'll be able to attend to the sick, and that's what I really need. And I won't always be so irritated and spurred to wrath. This is really the path of holiness. And then finally, the monk thinks up intellectual justifications for these feelings of anger and desire. God is not a material being, so he doesn't need to be worshipped in a specific place. I can worship him elsewhere. And he packages all of these reasonings under the heading of prudence. This is just what any rational and well-meaning person would do. Since the monk has been attacked all at once from every side, the whole of him falls all together and he enters into a deep depression. Evagrius and Cashin both note that falling for this temptation can paradoxically lead to frenetic activity. This frenetic activity serves to distract the monk from his interior hopelessness. Cashin distinctly asserts that it also leads to sloth, the refusal to act or to work at all. Despair about being and circumstances transforms naturally to despair about activity of any kind at all. And the monk is stuck in bed. This brings us to the end of the first chain that Cashin identifies and leads to a break. Vainglory and pride exist along a separate plane for this very specific reason. The demons of vainglory and pride do not come on the scene after a monk has fallen for another temptation, but rather they suggest these vices of vainglory and pride when the monk has instead been successful in overcoming previous attacks. This fact makes vainglory and pride the most difficult vices to root out. John Cashin remarks that while a vice like sexual lust is more terrible to experience and more oppressive in the concrete existential sense, a vice like vainglory is more difficult to overcome. Even overcoming it is itself an occasion for the same temptation. Even if you recognize that you're being vainglorious and repent of it, your next thought can be, it's so wonderful that I am awesome enough to overcome the temptation to vainglory. Maybe more people should know about this. John Cashin adds that when vainglory is defeated, it is all the more alive for having died. It's a vice that continually is raised from the dead. He observes that it is like a never-ending onion, with each peeled layer revealing a worse layer beneath. We could characterize vainglory and pride as pertaining to horizontal and vertical dimensions. In vainglory, the monk fantasizes and is greedy for a good reputation among his fellow men. This is the horizontal plane, and we saw it with our poor friend Angus last night. Angus. In pride, the monk loses sight, though, of the grace and mercy of God, and even of God as his creator, and refers all of this goodness to himself. And this is the vertical plane. As far as the proud monk is concerned, he is his own cause. He is the giver of all his own good gifts. He is his own God. In this sense, vainglory and pride together describe a closed loop of worship and glory. God's glory, which he wishes to share with us by transforming us into himself, is rejected. When glory is given to a monk from another, it is instead kept, savored, and guarded privately. The vainglorious monk has forgotten God's glory in pursuit of his own, and so he forgets that God is at all. He forgets that God has gifted him with being, life, intelligence, and holy desires. Thus, for Cashin, vainglory and pride stand as their own miniature chain, distinct from the previous chain of six vices. But they are not disconnected from those other vices entirely. As we're going to see, especially pride is at their root. In fact, though, first, let's say that the vices of vainglory and pride serve as a pressure release valve for the demons from the demonic perspective. The growth of a monk into maturation, the taming of his appetite, the quieting of his anger, patience in the face of sadness and despair, these all put pressure on the demons and anger them. One tactic that Evagrius describes is that the demons assigned to tempt the monk to baser passions like gluttony and lust may actually withdraw for a time, not in defeat, but rather to open the monk up to a flanking attack from vainglory or pride. Then, when vainglory and pride find success, they throw the monk back to the more elementary vices with greater fury than before. And I'm going to quote Evagrius here on this point. It's a bit lengthy, but the description is very vivid, so I think it's worth it. The thought of vainglory is most subtle, and it easily stands alongside the virtuous wishing to publicize their contests and to chase the praise that comes from people. It fabricates shrieking demons and healed women and a crowd of people touching their garments. It predicts he will gain the priesthood and makes people appear at his gates seeking to lead him away captive as if he were unwilling. That is, no, don't make me a priest. do make me a priest. Then, raising him high with empty hopes, it flies away and abandons him to be tempted either by the demon of pride or by that of sadness, which also bring to him thoughts contrary to his hopes. Sometimes it also hands him over to the demon of sexual lust, this man who just a moment before was taken captive to be a holy priest. The presentation of the order of the capital of vices that I have just walked through is highly simplified. That this is the case can be seen from the long quotation from Evagrius. From vainglory, you can fall into a series of different vices, and we could add more to the list than what Evagrius gives us. The same can also be said of a number of these other vices. It's not merely 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The advantage, though, of the simplicity of Evagrius and Cassian's classification is that is the same advantage that we discussed yesterday. A basic understanding of the relations between vices illustrates that the vices are not something that we're required to root out all at once, all together. John Cassian suggests the opposite. It is impossible, he says, for one who is concerned about the purification of his heart and has armed the attention of his mind for fighting any given vice, not to have a certain fear of all the other vices and a similar watchfulness with respect to them as well. And you can find similar advice across the Christian tradition. St. Francis de Sales says that we should reflect on a virtue which is most appropriate to us and pursue it. And when we gain it, we'll gain other virtues as well. Victory in a single vice redounds necessarily to an advantage over another. For this reason, the ordering of the capital vices is useful when we come to the task of diagnosis. It is possible that the vice that most bothers us may be merely the symptom of a more fundamental disease. If I find myself constantly flattering some and gossiping about others, the most helpful thing is not to gather willpower to stop these vices. This gathering of willpower might work for only a minute, but maybe only an hour. It might last for a whole day or even a week, but then it's going to run out. And as a result, I will become hopeless in this effort. Rather, according to this tradition, I should ask why I gossip. Perhaps I'm plagued with sadness. I'm plagued with a lack of contentment with my possessions, my place in life, my occupation, or even the specific time of my life. I gossip to relieve myself of this feeling of sadness, or I flatter to acquire that new possession or circumstance which I think will relieve my itching and unfulfilled desire. Another advantage of this paradigm is that it charts out in a reverse course a kind of itinerary of virtue. John Cassian describes temperance in matters of food and drink as a sort of entry ticket into the gladiatorial games of the monastic life. You must achieve a preliminary victory over the stomach to compete at all. After temperance is won comes chastity, and after chastity, poverty, and so forth. Again, this is oversimplified. But finally, the most hard-won virtue is acquired, humility, being a lifelong project. What is more, the journey is suited to the pilgrim. The successive obstacles grow in proportion to the one on the journey. John Cassian observes that the stronger the monk grows through successive triumphs, the more demanding the series of struggles that awaits him. Again, this is all a little oversimplified, but I think the simplicity and clarity is helpful. Even if the map of a proposed journey is not identical to the territory to be traversed, it's still good to have a map. But the possible, at least a possible disadvantage of this paradigm is that it might lead us to believe that the real problem with our human nature is that it is embodied. The chain of sins, after all, begin with the most basic desire, the most basic human desire for food. Cashin compares gluttony to a tiny back door in a walled city. Even if the city has an enormous and impenetrable gate, this gate can easily be opened from within if there is room for just one person to enter elsewhere. Gluttony is also only one of the first that must be faced on a daily basis. Every time that you sit down for a meal, it's lurking there somehow. And this is a function of the human body. A Syriac inheritor of Evagrius, Philoxenus, even says that gluttony is the mother of all the passions. And all of this adds up to give one the sense, perhaps, that it is our embodied state that is the problem. Our embodied state is the cause of our sin. But we get a very, I don't think this is true of John Cashin or Evagrius or even Philoxenus for that matter. But we get a very different picture from Augustine, which explains, I think, why St. Gregory the Great, two centuries later, would order the capital vices so differently. So first, I want to introduce a feature of Gregory's ordering, and then we'll get the explanation from Augustine. You'll see on your handout Gregory's ordering. For Gregory, it is pride, which is the capital of all the capital vices. Pride, for Gregory, is the queen of the vices, and so the cause of all the other vices. As Sirach 10:13 says, at least in the Latin translation of the Vulgate, pride is the beginning of sin. So every sin begins in pride. She is the one who first captures the soul, and then she hands it over to her seven generals, the capital vices, who themselves then hand the soul over to their many captains. So it begins with pride, moves into the capital vices, and from the capital vices we arrive at all the other sins. It is the inclination to pride, an inclination of the soul and not the body, that causes every other sin. Augustine, in fact, in a way exonerates the body as though it were a guilty bystander. For the corruption of the body, which weighs down the soul, is not the cause of the first sin, but its punishment. And it was not the corruptible flesh that made the soul sinful. It was the sinful soul that made the flesh corruptible. So yes, the body does weigh down the soul. Lust for food and sex do darken the mind's clarity and dampen the will's resolve. But in another sense, the soul weighs down the body by heaping the burden of sin and corruption onto it. The choice to turn from God arose from the choice of the free will, not from the inclination of the flesh. Augustine explains this point with respect to the fall of the devil. It is, in fact, not by the possession of flesh, which the devil did not possess, that man has become like the devil. It is by living by the rule of self, that is, by the rule of man. For the devil chose to live by the rule of self when he did not stand fast in the truth, so that the lie that he told was his own lie, not God's. The devil is not only a liar, he is the father of lies. He was, as we know, the first to lie, and falsehood, like sin, had its start with him. Augustine elaborates that the fountainhead of all these evils is pride, and pride reigns in the devil, although he is without flesh. And we could think with Augustine about pride in different ways. Pride as self-love, a love of self over God. Pride as a rebellion from God. But pride is also this rule according to self, taking yourself as the final and first principle. On this point, John Cashin agrees. Regarding pride, he says, there is no other vice then which so reduces to naught every virtue and so despoils and impoverishes a human being of all righteousness and holiness as does the evil of pride. For every other vice is satisfied with its own limits and its own end. And although it may afflict other virtues too, it is nonetheless directed principally against one and especially oppresses and assails it. This explains why pride is the most difficult vice to destroy, and it also explains why humility is a most fundamental virtue. And in fact, John Cashion emphasizes in his treatment of all the virtues that they are impossible without the virtue of humility. There is a clear and easy logic here. If you want to defeat a vice, you must acknowledge this vice in your person. If you acknowledge the vice, you have expressed an aspect of the virtue of humility. And one can easily see how the spiritual journey from vice to virtue into holiness, from ignorance into knowledge, from self-serving isolation into charity can be inflected by pride and brought to ruin. This happens when we make our spiritual maturation into a personal project or even our own personal spiritual brand. And as we've seen, this is self-defeating. When my maturation is my own personal brand, its purpose terminates in me and not in neighbor or God. When I am the final point of reference for myself, I interpret the world in the same sense. Food exists in order to give me pleasure. Other human bodies exist in order to give me pleasure. When I perceive that this pleasure is at risk, I become angry and I fight to preserve it, even if it comes to the detriment of my neighbor or even violence. When I see others experiencing the pleasures I desire for myself but which I lack, I'm saddened and use every effort possible to deprive them of this pleasure, not even to get it for myself, but in order to relieve me of my sadness. John Cashion explains the fundamental value of humility like this, if that's our description of pride. The superstructure of the virtues will never be able to rise in our soul if the foundations of true humility have not first been laid in our heart. When these have been very firmly posed, they will be able to hold up the peak of perfection and love. In order to do this, as we have said, we must first and from the deepest reaches of our heart exhibit true humility to our brothers by determining never to sadden or hurt them. The virtue of humility is fundamental because it is ordered to charity. Humility is a true view of oneself. The humble monk sees himself as requiring repentance, yes, but humility is not merely acknowledging lapses. Humility also sees positively. It sees that the self is not created for itself, but for the love of others. And furthermore, it sees that it can only fulfill this purpose with the help of God. Father John Mark, how am I doing on time?
You have 15 minutes.
Oh, I have 15 more minutes than I thought. That's good. John Cashion suggests this idea by way of proposing meditation on death as a cure for pride. The contemplation of our death is deadly not only to pride, but to all the vices in general. Then, after this, we must maintain the same humility most firmly with respect to God. This will be the case in us when we realize that we can accomplish nothing pertaining to the perfection of virtue apart from His assistance and grace. And also when we believe that the very fact that we have deserved to understand this point is in truth His gift. Even humility is a gift from God. In view of my talk yesterday, we might say that we can accomplish nothing pertaining to the perfection of virtue without the specific helps that God gives or allows, even when these include subjection to temptations that can be bewildering or discouraging to experience. Even these confusing temptations are an invitation to humility, and then by way of humility to all the other virtues. This understanding of humility and temptation is inflected in all the rest of Cashion's treatments of the virtues and vices. Everywhere he emphasizes that without humility, none of the other virtues is possible. Okay, so now I'm gonna propose two reasons for hope after being kind of glum. First, we have a great advantage in the sense that the virtues are a true unity of ordered peace. Every virtue makes every other virtue more possible, stronger, and more perfect. By contrast, the vices and the demons only cooperate with each other by way of a temporary truce. And one way of understanding the demons specifically is the model of the earthly city that Augustine gives in the City of God. According to the paradigm of the earthly city, which is ultimately ruled by Satan, there is a cooperation of rulers and their subjects according to a false form of peace. But, and this is an important point, each member, both the ruler and the ruled, lives according to a form of self-rule, by a love of self, by pride, and each is really, more truly, a slave of his own passions. The rulers are slaves to the passion of vainglory. They need their subjects because they need human beings to declare and proliferate the glory of their rule. The way that they coax glory out of their subjects is to supply the materials necessary for their subjects' own form of self-love, their own form of slavery. In the Roman Empire, these materials, as they really still are today, a ready access to wealth in material prosperity and comfort, a variety of consumables, foods, and also entertainments, but especially pornographic games and shows and easy access to public prostitution. This is what Augustine says. The more these subjects are slaves to their own passions by means of availing themselves of these things, the easier they are to control and the more readily they'll give glory to their masters. The demons are something like this. They work together, but only to keep up the illusion of their own control over themselves and others. Their aim is to make us like them. But because they aren't a unity, their temptations are often at odds with each other. The paradigm example is vainglory and sexual lust. On them, Evagrius writes, the demon of vainglory is opposed to the demon of sexual lust, and it is not possible for them to attack the soul simultaneously. Since one promises honors, and the other is an agent of disgrace. Thus, if either one comes and presses upon you, then form in yourself the thoughts of the opposing demon. This requires a little explanation. What Evagrius does not mean is that when tempted to vainglory, one should stir up lustful thoughts within oneself. Rather, when tempted to vainglory, one should remember with humility the weakness of the human condition and recall that it is subject to such temptations. A second reason for hope is related especially to humility. Cassian says that we ought to hold unwaveringly to two things. The first is that not one of these persons is ever tried without the permission of God, or is ever tempted without the permission of God. The second is that everything which is brought upon us by God, whether it appears sad or joyful at the time, is ordained as by a most tender Father and a most merciful physician for our benefit. Therefore, they are handed over, as it were, to pedagogues in order to be humiliated. Each temptation that God allows teaches this same virtue of humility. Consequently, each temptation that he allows is also an expression of his tender love for us. As a loving father, he desires this virtue in us because by it we are ordered to the love of God and the love of neighbor. We're ordered to the queen of the virtues, charity, and away from the queen of the vices. All the more by humility, we are ordered to the worship of God. When we are tempted, we can say with Augustine and the psalmist, God is great and greatly to be praised. God is worthy of our worship because he is mighty and just, but especially because he is merciful and tenderhearted. And so we can end with this Augustinian note that wherever we are in this chain of vices or virtues, we can make a twofold confession. First, we make a confession of sin, and we make this confession to someone whom we hope is going to forgive us. You only confess sins to someone you expect reasonably to be merciful. When you make that confession of sin, you're also making a confession of belief. I believe that you are merciful. And when you've made a confession, and when you made this confession of belief that he's merciful, you've also made a confession of praise. Praise to you because you are merciful. So we praise God because God is merciful, and God is so merciful that he assumed the form of a slave, subjected himself to temptation for our sake, and invited us through victory over the devil and the healing of our vices into an eternal life of peace and health. Great are you, O Lord, and greatly to be praised.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.